Suitable time when we can begin the morning session of this this meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. And so, unless there are objections, we'll call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. And first, I would like to formally introduce everybody at the head table. On my right is Professor Per Peterson of University of California, Berkeley. On my left is Bill Conway. And the three of us are the members of the committee. Next to Bill is Dr. Sheila Scheinberg, consultant to the committee, and Jim Booker, consultant to the committee. On my right is Rob Wellington, counsel to the committee, and Furman Wardell, consultant to the committee. Usually, at the beginning of the meeting, we open the floor to comments from visitors attending the meeting. Seeing none, and realizing this is early and a new location for our committee, we'll quickly move ahead to our business meeting. But if people do arrive later on and wish to make comments, we'll find a way to find space in the agenda for them. So we'll start with is the agenda that we had the same as the one in our packet?
That's correct.
Okay. We'll move directly to item Roman 4, which is the consent agenda. These are routine items which the committee can approve with a single motion and vote. And a member may request that any item be placed on the regular agenda for separate consideration. And the first item and only item I see on the consent agenda is the minutes of the June 1st meeting. First, a question. The minutes that I have read were an appendix to the annual report. Is that the same set of minutes that we're talking about?
That was the draft set. They were sent out in email and were attached, but they're in draft form only at this time.
Is the pink
and
version?
They're the same. They're the same as the pink version that you see.
Okay, so these are draft for approval at this meeting.
Correct.
Okay. Usually we try and go through at least to some extent page by page to see if there are any substantive comments. I urge you, if you have minor editorial comments that don't change the substance, that you would communicate those to Furman after the session.
Maybe to Rob would be better.
Rob's going to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Communicate them to Rob. Let's go quickly page by page and see if there are any items for discussion on the minutes.
I have just a question on page 2, Dave.
Page 2, okay.
Second paragraph, first sentence, Dr. Clough used photographic slides to illustrate, and it said it's included in Volume 2 of the transcript. Rob, I guess the question would be, do all of the slides and materials presented go on Volume 2 of the transcript such that a member of the public could go to the library, get that transcript, and see all the presentation slides?
Yes.
Okay.
So you can be selective about that. Right?
No, I think all of them are going to be.
All of
them?
Measurements in there. I'd suggest we be consistent, or actually my suggestion would be when we talk about meters, let's also parenthetically add feet and kilometers, miles, that sort of thing. And I'll be glad to work with Rob and Bob and get those conversions made.
Okay. Rob, will you just work with Furman and get those?
Do that.
Okay. Yep. Page 5 deals with our action items at the meeting.
I have a comment.
5-6.
Question on page 5.
5.
Item 6A, Roman numeral 6, item A. The very last line, we talk about refund of the 2004 grant balance. Do we want to put the amount in there? Would that be useful or not? Did we know the amount at that time?
We didn't know the amount at that time.
Okay.
No, you know what? I'm correcting. I'm correct myself. We did know the amount.
So I guess my question is...
It's not a major thing, and really it's just a financial adjustment. I don't see why we ought to bother.
Okay.
It's okay.
Okay. Page 6, 7. Pierre Dubé's name, I asked Sheila, and I think my understanding is that the spelling is D-U-B-E with a... accent on it rather than D-U-B-E-T.
That's correct.
Correct. So you want to find and replace and fix that one?
D-U-B-E, accent.
With a
accent aigu over the second E.
Yep.
It's a little more. I mean, that's where the T probably came out.
Pages 7, 8, and 9.
Is that on the page?
10, 11. On page 12, at the top, I'm kind of quoted as saying, encourage PG&E to establish contacts and so on, for an event at DCPP that required widespread news coverage. I thought I used a different word than required, and if I have a choice, I'd like to say that generated widespread news coverage. I don't know about required.
Okay.
That wouldn't be a word I would use. At least I don't think I did. And at the bottom of the page, the type of exercise is required to be conducted. That requirement is an NRC requirement, is it not? Anybody verify that?
Where are you, Dave?
I'm sorry. I'm at the bottom of page 12.
This copy is not the same as the
In terms of
the page
notes. That always happens. Okay.
What's the paragraph
during December 9th and 10th.
Okay, next page. Yeah. All right.
I'd just like to insert is required by NRC if, in fact, that's who requires it. I think it is.
During December 19th.
It isn't clear from the statement.
It is.
Who
it's
requires
required
it,
by the
but
license,
it is NRC.
The tech spec requires it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's required. So it should say
is required by NRC to be conducted.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
All right, pages 12, 13. On page 14, Rob,
Why don't you give us a start, the opening?
Yeah, well, it's a discussion that gets to the, update on employee concerns and then safety-conscious work environment. And the acronym SCWE, I didn't find any place where that was defined, and although I recognized it, it threw me off because we use it a lot, and it ought to be defined maybe the first time it's used. Okay. 14 and 15, or thereabouts. Just before review of NRC notices of violations, there's a short item, well, actually it's a long paragraph, that ends up that DCPP is working to engage its line organization and to format improved response. And I didn't know what format meant. Anybody remember that? You think those are? You see what I'm saying, Rob?
Yes, I see.
You think that's off the tape?
I'm not
formulate,
sure.
Formulate, maybe.
Formulate would be
formulate
better.
Improved response.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it should be taken out.
Okay. Otherwise, you might want to verify it, but it sounds that it should be taken out.
Either it should be taken out or just outage should be there, not the word non.
And there's a number sign before 130 on this copy, and I don't understand.
It's
that.
A less than or equal to. Is that what it really turns out?
Yeah, it's corrected in here. In the pink
word. Good. Okay. All right. We get through the public tour and
On page, about 22, it's Roman numeral 21.
21, okay, public tour.
It says, need synopsis of the tour.
I don't think so. Well, what do you want to do?
That's where Bob says, basically, we need a synopsis of the tour to go in the minutes here. I usually provide that. I was going to tell Rob that the synopsis for this tour is the same as for the previous tour.
Okay.
So
yes.
Just take
it. It's just three short paragraphs.
Yep.
That's correct.
Right. Okay.
But it needs to be put in these minutes.
Yep.
It's in my copy.
I put it in there. It's not in.
You have it in yours and not in
Well, maybe it didn't get in this version. It got
okay. Right. Well, then you'll see that it's there.
Yeah, okay.
Bob had taken my set out of the annual report and reprinted it here in pink, but I guess he didn't.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe not. All right.
It's already in there then.
Okay.
Let's go on to the public comments.
Item from numeral 22, questions and comments from the public. Maybe we should indicate there if there were any or not any. Sort of left me hanging as to...
Yeah, we offered, we stayed around informally, mm-hmm. but there were no formal discussions. Do we need that item?
It's part of the agenda. It was part of the agenda.
Okay.
What we can do is, you know what, we can
just
put
say
a generic statement that the members and consultants conversed and answered questions informally with the members of the public who had questions.
Okay. Yeah, something along those lines.
That would be good.
Perfect.
Okay, into the public comments. There were several items that Klaus Schumann suggested and requested that we do, and there is no response to those. I don't recall that we made any formal response, but I thought that the tone of our comments were that we didn't really think specific responses to his comments were necessary. Anybody can add to that recollection?
I don't think we made responses, but I don't know that there was any. And I thought this reflected we just didn't make responses.
Furman, do we need some more words there in your view?
Well, when I read this, I saw there were several requests of the committee, and I thought we ought to respond to those requests. Maybe we did we respond, Rob, that day?
Well, there's on the top of my page 26, and I don't know where that would be on the pink copy, it says Dr. Rossin addressed Mr. Schumann's comments.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I maybe that takes care of it.
Okay, maybe that does take care of it.
Then that is in the pink one?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Let me back up a couple paragraphs, Dave.
Okay.
Paragraph starting, Mr. J. Adams.
Mm-hmm.
The next to the last line, after DCPP, I believe the word no, N-O, should go there. No formal studies.
Yes.
I think you're right. That I think that was the essence of his comment.
I think so, too.
Okay, so we'll insert the negative there. Okay.
Otherwise, the sentence doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Let's move to the next Roman item 27. That was the beginning of PG&E's presentation. I think we have a different title heading for 27. Do we?
It says information items continued.
That's what we always use.
That instead of that, it should say PG&E reports.
No. Because they'd already report. I mean, over on back on page 20, we had reports.
Right. So that's what we've always used.
These are PG&E information items
right.
before the committee.
Right.
These are further ones because we started them over. Remember, we started the day with PG, or you know, we started the. First day. This is the morning. This is the afternoon of the second day. I think.
Okay.
Yep.
Any comments in that section? The first item was emergency core cooling systems.
I have a question. Before that, Dave.
Not that helpful to add information.
Any objection to deleting that line?
No.
It is confusing. I thought when I read it too fast, that the walls above the water were 6 inches of concrete. So that was confusing, too.
They are.
So we'll delete that line.
It's much thicker. But the refueling building does have a concrete roof that's of that order of thickness. So that may be what they were referring to. But it's going to cause confusion.
I think so, too.
Okay, so that line comes out. Anything more on the ECCS discussion? Systems Engineering Program Review? And the conclusions. Right at the end, we talked about a list of nuclear power-related acronyms. Do we know where that is? Anybody take that on?
Where are you, Dave? What paragraph are you?
I'm right at the end.
Under 28, Roman numeral 28?
Just before the adjournment.
Oh, I see.
It seems to me I've seen this in 100 different places.
It's in our annual report. There's an exhibit in the back that has acronyms and other definitions. Now, what Bob Rathy has done is he's put these acronyms on our website.
They're on the website, yeah.
That's what this sentence is saying.
Yeah.
Okay, so this has been completed since the minutes were written. Fine. We'll leave it as it is.
I'd like to back up to the previous paragraph.
Okay.
Next to the last sentence, quality review of the oversight. I think the word quality should go before the word oversight. So review of the quality oversight is which yard works. Bill, is that correct? Isn't that correct?
Where are you? I'm not
fine with either.
All right.
The bold print.
The bold print.
Okay. Mr. Wardell.
Yeah.
Next to the last line where it says quality review of the oversight. You see that paragraph?
And it should be a review of the quality oversight?
Yeah, the word quality needs to be moved over.
So it's a review of the quality of?
Quality oversight.
Quality oversight.
Quality oversight, okay.
Just move quality right over to just before oversight. Right here. Move quality right over.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that determines who does it.
I've got it marked on my copy. So.
Okay, sorry.
Any further comments on the minutes? Do I hear a motion?
I move to accept the minutes.
As amended?
As amended.
As amended. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved, and that item is finished. Donna, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Good morning.
And you've missed the thrilling reading of the minutes of the last meeting.
Sorry, I missed
it. And you haven't missed much. So now we will return to our agenda. And the action items before the committee. And the first one is the annual report of the... and wait a minute, we're going to have a discussion of the annual report, are we not?
This is it.
This is to discuss and approve.
Yeah, this is to discuss and approve.
Discuss and approve.
I see. Once again, there's a difference between the yellow agenda and the white agenda. The white agenda is the one we're following. Is that correct? The one that's handed out at the meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. And the one in the rainbow package is not the operative one.
I'm going by this one.
We all are from this point on.
They're the same, Dave.
Well, they are and they aren't.
They're formatted slightly differently.
The thing is, the white one has our suggested times on it.
That's not the difference.
So let's use that one because then we'll all be, as they say, on the same page.
There you go.
Furman has provided us with first and second drafts of the annual report. And Furman, why don't you take over the discussion and see where we go from here?
Right. Right, we've, since August, the middle of August, we've been through two draft reviews of the annual report. And based on comments I've received, I sent to you last week, I forgot the date, emailed to you the executive summary of that report with conclusions and recommendations. So this is the meat of the report. Other changes to other sections of the report are not very substantial.
My original review comments were all addressed to my satisfaction, so I don't have any additional comments on the annual report.
Bill?
I don't have any additional comments either.
Yeah, mine were also addressed. Sheila?
I have some concerns with some deletions in some of the sections that I did. Do you want to discuss those here or offline?
Well, we probably should have discussed them over the last month or two. What's your preference?
Offline is fine.
Let me ask, if I may, Sheila, are these comments that affect the executive summary conclusions and recommendations, or just the text in those sections?
They affect some recommendations.
Then we probably should talk about those here.
Okay.
At some point during the next 2 days, we should talk about those.
Okay.
I'll refer to Rob, but actually, if you can make the changes, you probably ought to discuss that in public, shouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Any changes to the report of any nature, other than just editorial, should be made at this time, or in the meeting, and maybe it doesn't need to be done right now. You might continue it over.
Well, I think we'll discuss anything substantive now.
Yep.
Rob, are there any things that you want to throw in right now or bring up?
No.
And Truman, any other feedback that you've gotten since then that didn't require attention?
No feedback.
Okay, well, and Sheila, let's go look at the various items in question and talk about them.
I'm not looking at the same draft you are. I'm looking at a second draft.
The one we set up was called the final draft.
I don't have a copy of the final draft.
Yeah, that was emailed to you last week.
Now, in the final draft, are the ones that she's talking about liable to be underlined and scored so we can identify them?
No, they've changed since the second draft. She will. The ones that she's referring to are ones that have already been changed and set out. Let me suggest this. Let me talk to Sheila during the break or during the day and try to work out what might have happened to her concerns. Maybe they made it to the final draft.
Okay.
And then we can come back and discuss those more concisely. Would that be good?
Sure. Well, I think that would be certainly...
That's fine with me.
...better use of the time. But I think some of them are substantive, and so we should get back into a discussion of that. And maybe if you'll make a point of doing it on this morning's break, we can still discuss it this morning.
We should do that, and possibly lunch. It might take lunchtime, Dave. But I've got an annotated copy here of all the comments for the second draft.
Okay.
I can work over with Sheila.
And Sheila, since I was probably the one who called for these changes, I'll get in on this with you if needed.
That would be good.
Okay. Well, knowing that we're going to do that, let's move on to our other agenda items in this section, action items, an update on financial matters. Rob, do you have?
I do, and I will pass these out, your copies, but we just got them yesterday, and I printed them up, and I brought with me. But just to briefly comment, we have Diane Key has run our financial statements through September, and we have a current balance of $136,316. And in looking at last year's report at or about the same time, we were at $85,000 last year. So we are doing well.
And that does not include the last quarter.
And that does not include the last quarter.
Right.
We have also billed, For the last quarter, we have billed and have yet to receive from PG&E the quarterly payment of, which is, I think, $192,000. So that's yet to come in. And we did, and as I indicated, we mentioned in the minutes, and the amount of the of 2004 grant that was sent back to PG&E was just a little over $12,000.
We've got at least one fact-finding meeting that isn't included in that 130, I would bet.
Probably the one in September.
Yeah,
late September.
I doubt that your
bills... Probably doesn't include that. Yeah, your
bills haven't come in yet. This meeting, and
yeah, I haven't billed for September. It wasn't much, but I haven't billed just because I usually wait until after the public meeting and do it.
Well, yeah, there are going to be the usual
monthly
billings from the contractors. Per, do you have a fact finding schedule during the rest of the year?
Yes, we have one in November.
November?
No,
you?
We have one in late November.
And I don't. So that's during that period.
Right.
So
I will just indicate there's a couple potential items of cost. You know that we tried. We're working with the whole group, which includes PG&E, the PUC, the governor's office, et cetera. We tried to set up a meeting last week in San Francisco with our regulatory council on the discussion that we're having relative to the amendment and revision of Appendix C. That deals with the charter for the committee. That meeting did not get set. Rochelle Becker was out of the country, and other folks weren't available. So we're going to try to schedule that meeting, hopefully later this month. So there will be a little bit of activity in that regard. We'll keep you informed. We also have some additional expenses. You know, we're doing we've rented the vans for the tour. So that's some expense, but all of this that falls within our outreach direction, for which we are keeping track, and we will be asking for additional compensation relative to outreach to the extent it's not covered. Additional compensation from PG&E for that.
Okay, well that sounds like we're going to be within our financial capability
this
year.
Yes,
as best we can project it.
We talked about an audit.
Yeah.
When is that?
The audit is being undertaken. You might recall, I mean, the question was whether we went back and audited back at the time. You remember that contract came, I think it was one of those meetings that we concluded before we retained the auditor. So the auditor has been retained, and they are doing their work for the 2004-2005 fiscal year. So they're in the process of working on that right now.
Well, I only asked in terms of the budget.
Yeah.
When would you expect that cost to be submitted? Would that impact what we're talking about at this moment?
It could. I think there's probably still, just looking at, as I say, looking at last year to this year, I think we're still probably okay.
It was not a significant amount, as I recall.
$7,500 or something like that.
Yeah, a couple.
How much?
$7,500.
We should certainly... Can we ask them to bill for 2005 expenses early on?
We can.
And include that in our 2005 fiscal year and the balance in next year?
Yeah, I'll check with them. That's a good I'll find out what they've done and how they would like to bill it. And I'm sure they'd be happy to bill a little bit in advance.
We don't really operate on an accrual system, which makes our accounting somewhat unrealistic.
Yeah.
But here's a case where we are thinking correct for that a little bit.
Okay. I think that's a good idea. That's all I have.
Any other financial matters?
And I have copies for you all that I'll get out to you.
Okay. Furman, let's proceed with the open items at this point. And then we might move up our break, or well, we'll see how long that discussion goes. Okay?
Yes. I sent out to the committee, I believe it was last week, the latest update to the open items list. In the bottom left, the margin is called the 10/05 public meeting. And this is also reproduced in the rainbow packet in the golden paper. Same document. And I've updated this since the last meeting, to the best of my knowledge, based on fact-finding meetings and other item activities, events, decisions that are taking place within the committee. Dave, usually we walk through each section asking for any major comments, mm-hmm. and I'll be glad to do that. Any editorial or others, I suggest maybe someone get with me later. Shall we start that way?
Let's start, and let's take them item by item. The first, conduct of operations. Any questions or comments? And we're all working from the same pages this time.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
A drawing, except for Furman.
Well, I've got that on the chair,
okay.
too. I've got both.
All right, conduct and maintenance.
I'll just add on CM10, the second item, the online maintenance was reviewed in the early September fact-finding meeting. I've added that to this list, just FYI.
Oh, okay.
So we won't look at that third or fourth quarter this year as in the right column, but probably the third quarter of next year.
All right. Engineering program. Any items there? We have another half dozen items. All right, let's go on. The HP items, human errors and improving safety and effect actively, probably almost every fact finding.
We are. I just wanted to be sure we had all that in there.
Okay.
That's all.
Emergency preparedness. Yeah. Two items.
I would just say there in general, we say next action will be next drill. We are still looking for a drill schedule from PG&E. Kent, I know it's Kent Oliver's here. Do we have new key dates for next year for the drills and things yet, Kent?
I don't have those dates yet, but I'll follow up from this meeting before I get that
date. Yeah, I can let you know on that, that we have a ERO, Emergency Response Organization Team Leadership Meeting. We held that Monday. We reviewed the draft dates, and so those are in review, and when they get finalized, we can send those out to you.
That'd be just fine.
Okay.
Thanks.
Let's take a second here. With regard to the force-on-force drills, there's nobody from the committee. You finally got the communication on that, didn't
no.
you?
No.
It's going to be
I'll set that.
To me, at least.
I thought there were different dates than the ones coincidental with this meeting.
They were actually, yeah, October 13th.
It's next week, isn't it?
This week.
Yeah,
you sent those to me.
You know, I ordered an email on that, but I don't remember the exact dates in that course. And of course, I believe it's next week.
See, the next week, though.
Furman forwarded one that had you on his distribution list, so I thought you had gotten it.
I sent that to everyone. Well, the note Kent had sent to me with the force.
But you're not going to be around here next week, are you?
No.
I had communicated with Furman recommending that we review that at the fact-finding meeting in November, review the results of
Right. So there won't be, Kent, there won't be any observer next week.
That's October 17 and 18, by the way. Those are the dates.
Yeah. But if we can get the schedule for next year, then that would be an appropriate time for us to observe. Depending on, we can decide after we review at the fact-finding.
Okay.
Have we attended any of their emergency drills this year?
Yes. This past year? Yeah, one.
Or this year?
Yes, we went to...
I don't think we had.
No, the last one, I think, was in December of
2004. Yeah, I don't think we've attended any this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was yours back in December?
Time flies.
Y'all attended the full-scale drill in December.
Yeah,
of last
the open items, as you see. December 2004 was our last action, was our last fact-finding on that drill. So it's been almost a year.
Yeah. And we have a standing recommendation that emergency drills include some aspects related to security, mainly because we want to make sure that the changes that have occurred in security have not had negative impacts on emergency response, because there's some potential for negative interactions. So this is just a general area where I think the whole industry needs to work out over the next couple of years to make sure that the security upgrades don't have negative impact on things such as getting fire equipment into the site,
right.
and other things that we know that you could have some problems in terms of the coordination or conflicts.
Now, I'll let you know that this summer we performed, it was really the first tabletop with, it was with the NRC, it was FEMA, it was local law enforcement. We had our station ERO participating, and it was what we call the integrated consequences management. So it was a security-based threat. And what we did was have all of those key players, including the county and the state, and then coordinated how this would all happen. And it's something that the NRC is looking at to say, is this something we want to go forward with, coordinated through NEI? So we had all those participants there, and really a lot of positive marks on how we would facilitate getting equipment in and out of the station to support such a threat. So I don't know if there's a report that we could forward to the members on that, but let's look at that. That might be something that would be helpful
maybe,
for you.
Maybe
to
we could cover that in the fact finding.
Well, I was going to suggest okay. The same thing. Pierre and I will be at the station on November the
6th and
7th. I believe Kent knows the dates. We could take a look at that at that time.
I think that would be a good item for you to
If
review.
There is a unclassified version
right.
of a report that exists now, that you could send, that Kent could send for information, I think we would all be very eager to read it. But I understand there are things you can and can't do.
Okay.
I will take that.
Okay.
Thanks, there should be a full-scale drill in 2006.
That's
right?
Correct.
To you. So we ought to plan on, whenever that is next year, someone ought to plan on attending.
That's
well,
a good idea. Yeah.
This force-on-force drill...
I'm talking about a regular emergency drill.
I understand that. This force-on-force drill is going to be an important one for you people. And I'm sure we'll be interested in learning about that. And that may well be a topic in your fact-finding.
Yeah, I think it would be good for us to review that as well. And
SOC meetings?
Bill and I have scheduled for 10.
You're going to do that one?
That's in November 16th, 17th, I believe it is.
All right.
When will be the next NSOC meeting after that? Because I should attend at least one just to.
You haven't had a chance to do that.
No, I have not.
2006 NSOC schedule is not out yet. That should be out this month.
Okay, when it comes out, if we could get it, then
you'll have one in the first quarter for sure.
Okay. But, yes.
Yeah.
And you are on distribution for that. Soon.
Yeah, we'll get that.
Okay. Good. Good.
Radiation protection?
Yeah.
Quality programs. Anything to add on quality programs?
Nothing for me.
Fuel performance? Equipment reliability, life cycle management. Okay. Equipment reliability. No, that's life cycle management. Organizational effectiveness and development. We're going to be discussing that today. Let's see where that leads. System equipment, system and equipment performance and problems. And steam generator. We're getting down into fairly detailed items. For a minute, are there any that you want to call attention to?
Not until the last couple of pages.
Why don't you jump to that?
All right. Page 6, next to the last item, which is item number 4 under the June 5th public meeting. Next action says awaiting PG&E. I just noticed that has been completed and can be closed.
Good. Now, did you guys review that?
I sent this out to the committee last week. This is an email Kent sent to me, which I forwarded to the committee.
Okay, that's why I haven't seen it. Okay.
The audit we get anyway, but the DCPP vendor manual policy and procedures is what Kent sent to me, and I sent to the committee last week, email.
We've got a couple of items above that on the same page that date back to Phil Clark recommendations. One is closed, the other isn't. Or is it?
Which one, Dave?
No, it's not.
The second item on this page, on page 6.
What's the item number on the left-hand column?
It's
18.
PM 18.
Okay.
And it says that's combined.
Yeah, mine
include with item ER5 above. Okay. Has that been taken care of?
Let me look. I suggest in the right-hand column, ER5, I suggest that be done the first quarter of 06.
Okay, so that's the tie-in.
That's the tie-in.
Okay, fine.
That's how I incorporated Phil's recommendation into our standard open items.
Okay. Anything more? Page 7?
Yeah, page
yes.
7, item 8. I'm sorry, Sheila, do you have something?
Item 7.
Oh, 7. Okay, go ahead.
On page 7.
Yeah.
Where it talks about remain attentive to the idea of safety culture. I would not close that one. I don't think you should close that one. And the reference to HS-5 only says that Donna Jacobs is now the responsible party for safety culture.
Okay,
I think they're very different. And I don't think you should close that one. I think that should be an open item.
Item HS-5 says follow DCPP progress in establishing / improving its safety culture.
Right.
So that's why this one was taken up.
This one, I think this one is different. Encourage PG&E to remain attentive to the idea of safety culture and the distinctions between safety culture and safety-conscious work environment.
All right. Well, I would suggest...
I think that issue should continue to be reviewed along with the other recommendations. I don't think they're one and the same.
Okay.
I don't think Donna being put in charge of that is a solution to safety culture.
No, I agree with you.
Okay.
All right. Allow me on the next list to take this wording and move it up to add to HS5.
That'd be fine.
Okay. That's what I hope to do here, but I see your distinction. I'll include that in HS5 next time, explicitly.
Thank you.
And Bill, you had something on this page?
Number 10? We don't have a...
Yeah.
I've not seen a response to that. Is anybody else?
Yeah, some time back, Bill, a month or so ago, PG&E sent an email which I forwarded. Was that contractors wouldn't direct?
Yeah, I'm sure we do keep a record of that. I don't have that information with me. There aren't any significant trends that have been identified from that. We do include our contractors in all of our human performance simulator that we use when we bring in contractors, especially now getting ready for our refueling outage that starts on the 24th. So we review safety practices with them. We can sure do a follow-up and present the contractor safety data if you'd like to see that either in a fact-finding or in a future meeting.
I'll take the action for that now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. General and administrative, anything there?
Before you get to that, item 8 on the last page 7 of the open items list, I would add that's been completed by PG&E and can be considered closed.
Okay. I think we're going to cover fact-finding meetings and reports in our meeting today, and that's just a constant item that's always there, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Anything else? We're toward the end of this package. Okay. It's almost 9:30. I'd like to suggest that we take a break now, particularly to give Furman and Sheila a chance to look at the item that involves recommendations. And when our agenda says we're going to come back at 10 o'clock, let's come back at 10:10. Let's come back at 10 o'clock. Maybe we can make it a little before then. Because I'd like to ask Jim Booker to tell us a little bit about what Hurricane Rita did to his part of the country and some of the implications and findings about the utility infrastructure. And I know that he's been living with that. So Why don't we say we'll reconvene at 10 minutes of 10, and Jim will be the first agenda item, and then we'll catch up with our remaining agenda items. Okay?
Good.
Is this your?
I don't know. I think that's your.
We'll reconvene our morning session of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. I've asked our consultant, Jim Booker, from Beaumont, Texas, to tell us a little bit about the experiences of Hurricane Rita and some of Katrina. Tell us a little bit about what he has seen and heard and what's happened to his house and everything else, but also about the infrastructure there and lessons that would be of interest to us. And, Jimmy, you can do it from your chair or maybe from the podium would be better.
I'll just do it from here, the chair.
Okay, make sure you've got the mic so that they can hear you.
Is the mic on? Yeah, okay. Hurricane Rita started out in the Atlantic Ocean and then just went sort of south of Key West, Florida, as a Category 1, which is about a 75-mile-an-hour hurricane.
I want you to pull your mic up closer.
And then moved on into the Gulf of Mexico into warmer waters, and it increased to a Category 2 and then a Category 3. Initially, it was headed towards sort of south Texas down into the Corpus Christi Freeport area. And then it increased to a Category 4 and a Category 5 hurricane with winds up to 175 miles an hour. And they were predicting a 20 to 25-foot water surge with that. And then it started cooling a little bit north, and they were thinking about maybe Matagorda Bay up toward Galveston. Galveston was destroyed in 1900 by a hurricane that hit it. So they ordered an immediate evacuation of Galveston. I guess that was Tuesday, 20 to 21st. And then also they ordered an evacuation of the low-lying areas between Galveston and Houston. Talking about a little over a million people trying to evacuate from that area. And Wednesday night, that's where we thought it was going into, south of Galveston. That's about 100 to 125 miles from us. It wasn't a big deal for us. For them it was, but not for us. Thursday morning, woke up and it changed direction. It was headed northeast. It's heading right toward Beaumont, right between the Louisiana and the Texas border there. And it hit landfall that Friday night or Saturday morning. A lot of trees knocked down the distribution line, but also their transmission lines and substations were destroyed all over the state. Not all over the state, but all over the energy service area. Entergy had been hit earlier 3 weeks by Katrina down in New Orleans and in Mississippi, Gulfport, Biloxi, Mississippi. So they had a lot of crews, not only all their crews, but crews all over the United States down in that area. So here they had to call in. They had crews from AEP in Ohio. They had crews from public service, electric and gas from New Jersey. They had crews from Kansas. They had 7,000 utility crews in our area trying to restore power. And if they had not done that, we were without power 2.5 weeks. We went back in just on Saturday after it came in to check on things, and Beaumont was just dark. It was just dark. I mean, I didn't know when it would get like that. They were talking about maybe a month before it would get like that. Entergy and the utility industry as a whole did a very good job, and utilities always work together in catastrophes like this. Whenever they had the ice storms up east, Entergy sent crews up east to help with ice storms. So the way they exchanged is very, very good. And if they hadn't done that, I don't know how long it would have been. Louisiana actually got hit first because they were on the northeast of the island. So they had a 15-foot water wall going through there. And it wiped out Cameron completely, which was wiped out in 1957 hurricane back then. Lake Charles got hit very bad. So I've never seen devastation like that before. I mean, we lost 5 big trees that were 2 feet streaking diameter, roots and everything up. We were very fortunate none of it hit our house. There were a lot of houses, including our friend's house at our church, that they had big pine trees split their houses in half. So So most of the damage was not in the wind. So I didn't lose a single shingle off my roof, which is like, and not many people did that. But the tree damage did a tremendous amount of damage to houses and utility poles and streets. When we got, when we first went back in, some streets you couldn't go down. There was full of trees. But they're doing a good job of cleaning it up and working hard. A lot of contractors. So, you know, we were not devastated like the flooded area in New Orleans was. So.
Jim, you said your house got some power back yesterday, the day before.
Monday. 2.5 weeks back. We were lucky. There's still people without power.
But
and then out in rural areas, that's where it's really going to be slow because, you know, out in the country where there's, you know, not maybe a dozen of customers out there and all the distribution going to them. You know, they're picking up the areas to provide service to the largest number of customers they can first.
Can anything function in that town without the electric power back in service?
Oh, no. This is out. At first, we're putting power back into hospitals. Hospitals were evacuated. Right toward the end, we evacuated probably close to 2 million people. If they had to evacuate a large city like Houston, I don't think they could do it. There's just not... And they've got interstate highways all over the place going east and west and north. But I mean, they were on Interstate 45 going up toward Dallas. They blocked off the southbound lane, and so everything was going northbound. We're talking about national emergency, terrorism or anything else. So evacuation of a big city is almost impossible.
So, Jim, what were the effects on any nuclear plants in the vicinity?
It's my understanding that the South Texas project, which is down in the Bay City, shut down.
Yeah. South Texas was shut down?
Yeah, they shut down beforehand, but it was headed right toward them.
How close were they to, say, where the epicenter came through?
Far away. It turned northeast, so it missed them completely. Because you go over to Houston and Galveston got a lot of coverage on TV. They had very little damage over there. And South Texas is even further south than that. So I'm sure they were back up running the next day.
So were any other nuclear plants affected besides
No, is Waterford's on the Mississippi River there in New Orleans. Should not. Waterford shut down during Katrina, I understand.
Waterford is what?
Waterford is the energy nuclear plant.
Yeah.
Right there just north of New Orleans on the Mississippi River. And then River Bend is the one I was associated with, north of Baton Rouge. It was unimpaired.
They reduced power, though.
Yeah, right, just in case. They reduced power in case they lost transmission lines. Yeah.
There's no place for the power to go.
Right. Well, you don't want to trip those units that, you know, when the lines go down. You really have them down a much lower power. Mm-hmm.
And were they still on some grid power, or were they strictly on emergency power?
I would imagine Waterford would probably, I don't know the details, but I would imagine Waterford would be probably transmission line, probably, yeah. River Bend probably transmission line.
When you went back to your house, what did you find?
Trees. I was lucky, the trees all fell in the front yard and backyard, and none of them on the house. Big trees, yeah. But I did. Neighbor's tree did fall in my garage and my workshop, and I tore holes in that. But that's minor compared to the damage that a lot of other people have. Our daughter, who lives out of Fort Nature, chimney fell on her roof and knocked a hole in it, so she got a lot of water in her house. But still, structurally, our family was lost.
You mentioned something about the food in the refrigerator.
We were also had two very good son-in-laws who went in just as soon as they could. In fact, the day after the storm. Threw all the food out of the refrigerator and freezers away because there were people going back in the homes this last week and the refrigerators were ruined because of that. The smell is so bad. We got rid of ours.
Questions for Jim or comments?
But I tell you, I'll say one more time, the cooperation between the utilities with each other is a really, you know, there's deregulation, there's competition, everything's going on. But when they're in trouble, they get each other out.
Jim, tell me something about the plans that are in place between utilities that would apply to a situation like this.
Well, First, the interview was well prepared because they had just gone through one 4 weeks ago about bringing people in and restoring power. All utilities, as far as I know of, have an agreement with other utilities to assist them in sending their crews to help out during any kind of emergency, whether it be a ice storm or a hurricane or whatever. And I mean lots of them. I saw hundreds of PSE&G utility trucks down in that area. Hundreds. They must not have had any trucks left up there in a minute.
How'd they get them down the highway when it was all blocked? Everybody going the other way?
They had highway patrol. Well, they didn't come down until after it was over. They're not going to come down until the storm's over. So, and then the highways were blocked. And they were actually, highway patrols escorted them in. They went in pretty fast.
Any other thoughts on the subject? Good. Appreciate it, Jim. Thank you very much. When you get back home, what are you going to do?
Get the yard, man, clean up the yard.
Do you have a big chainsaw?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Chainsaw.
Get a contract to fix it.
So you're not going to need to haul in wood for a while, I imagine.
I have lots of
nice, good supply.
If I need the wood, I'll send it.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next item is committee member reports and discussion. And we've got an item on public outreach, site visits, and other committee activities. Rob, is this your baby here?
No, this is just for any of you to report on any issues of site visits or fact findings, and of course there will be fact finding reports, just any other general activities since the last meeting.
Well, we didn't attempt any specific public outreach activities.
No. We have the tour. We're scheduled. We have the process set up for our public tour tomorrow. But other than that, I don't know that there's been any, unless that I don't know. Sometimes there's, on occasion, members will meet with their appointing entities or so forth. But I don't think any of that's occurred this last quarter.
Not since the last public meeting.
Not since the last public meeting.
How was the public response to the public tour this time in terms of the number of people that want to go?
The tour filled up. I was mentioning to a few folks earlier this morning that this was the, I think, the first time that the tour didn't fill up in the first couple hours. It's advertised, and I can't remember what morning it's on. Everyone's kind of geared in the office. To answer phones, and sometimes it fills up within an hour or two, and this time it didn't fill up for it took 2 days, so the response was a little more moderated than usual, but it did fill up with all the spaces that we had available.
Let's just double check the logistics so we don't forget it later on. You want to just mention where and when tomorrow morning and so on?
Yeah, the tour, and I look at the agenda. I think
eight o'clock
tomorrow morning, starting at the PG&E Visitor Center, just off of Highway 101, near San Luis Bay.
Same place as always. How much time to allow tomorrow morning?
To get from here to there, you mean?
Yeah. What time should we make sure we're out of here in order to be there, Ken?
I would allow close to an hour. You're talking about leaving here and getting out there?
To the visitor center?
Yeah, I'd allow about an hour.
Just because of traffic?
Traffic that time of the day, just to be sure. A lot of people start coming early sometimes there.
Okay.
45 minutes for sure.
Sure, okay.
We will have a little presentation in the visitor center before we board the buses.
Yes.
We have two buses or one?
Two.
Two buses. Will the visitor center people be on hand for the show and tell?
Yes, they will.
Okay, but they're not going to drive the bus this time?
No.
So, want to say anything more about that?
No.
Will we have one of the ladies on each one of the buses?
I believe it's been set up that way so that you get a tour guide on each van.
Each
bus.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good. Great. Same arrangement we've done for the last two or three.
Okay. Except different drivers.
Except different drivers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that means 7-ish, we got to get out of here.
Yep.
So their breakfast isn't ready at 7 o'clock. Okay.
We'll see what we can do. I'll talk to them and see what I can do about that.
Well, there's a coffee pot out in the hall. We can have that and maybe a roll or two.
Save the bagels.
I could just have a little cotton on the back. Well,
the bagels will be just as hard tomorrow as they are today. Okay. Any comment on documents provided, Bob? Rob?
Just to note, the documents provided are in your green sheets and in the rainbow packet. These are the cover sheets that list all of the documents provided to you as part of the direction from the establishment of the committee and provided by PG&E on a regular basis.
So our rainbow package is our reference book.
Yes, it's your agenda packet that we have in front of you, and it's available for folks to look at.
All right, we're ahead on time, but I don't see that there's any reason that we can't begin our consultant reports on the fact-finding meetings. So, Furman, you're up first.
I'll report on the September 21 and 22, 2005 fact-finding meeting that Bill Conway and I conducted at the station. On the screen and handed out to members and consultants of the committee are the 12 items. You can't see 12 because it's off the screen. Let me slide that up right now. And I'll briefly cover each of those items, and if you have any questions or comments, please stop me. At each item. And Bill, of course, chime in anytime you want.
Sure.
The first thing we looked at was the corrective action program through the eyes of the quality verification, or QV, department. Corrective action has been a significant issue at Diablo Canyon for the past year and a half. And we wanted to take a look and see how they were coming along with their improvements. They have quite a comprehensive corrective action improvement plan. And we wanted to see how the assessments of that had been going. We met with several representatives of quality verification, including the manager, Dave Taggart, and reviewed the first item A there, 1A, an assessment they had done back in the spring. And they gave us their assessment of how well they were doing in meeting both the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, INPO, and Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, expectations and requirements. All members and consultants of the committee have received this audit. Bottom line, basically, is that a number of improvements were noted. They were well on their way. However, there was one significant issue raised, which dealt with some long-standing equipment problems, that we went over a couple of those with them. One is the refueling water storage tank leakage, which has been going on for some time. They're now just now getting, I think, a handle on that, and the committee plans to follow up on that particular item.
I will add and report that the latest work we did on the refueling water storage tank for Unit 2 did fix the last of the leakage. We had been working that off systematically and identifying valves that have been leaking. All this leakage was internal to systems. And we had been narrowing down on it, and the last work that we had, actually about 3 weeks ago now, fixed that leakage, and so there's no leakage from that tank.
Okay.
And it was associated with valves?
Yes.
Oh. Good. Well, we can still may want to follow up, but thanks for that update, Donna. Appreciate that. In the QPAR, or Quality Performance Assessment Report, we had at the end of second quarter, the overall performance assessment for the corrective action program by QV was white, which means good but not excellent. They were working their way toward green, which you're familiar with the color ratings that they have. We will hear tonight about the third quarter QPAR from PG&E. We'll see how the corrective action program is rated in that one. I don't know if it's made green yet, but we'll take a look and see. It may still be white. But they've got an excellent plan, a very comprehensive plan. Also, we learned that the NRC has removed their substantive cross-cutting issue on problem identification and resolution, which is their way of saying corrective action program. That had just happened in late August at the mid-cycle assessment letter. So that was good news for the plant. QA mentioned that they would be, and I think by now they have been, reorganized a bit. At least they're now reporting straight to Dave Oatley. So they are more independent than ever. I believe that organizational change has taken place. Donna's nodding yes, and we'll probably hear more about that tonight. So I won't say any more about that. Bill, anything to add to that item?
No, I don't think so, Frank.
Before you move on, I have a question.
Yeah.
Did you look at the impact of the Corrective Action Review Board on the Corrective Action Program?
We didn't look at that specific item. That was done on a previous fact finding, I think, that Jim's going to report on. We were cognizant of CARB, the organization you mentioned, and that was one of the action items in their plan. In fact, that was one of the things, I think, that led NRC to remove the substantive cross-cutting issue. Quality verification was very high on the CARB. So we didn't look at it in detail, but we did look at it just in sort of at a high level.
Thank you.
I guess I would add that the NRC also concurred that the CARB was performing much more effectively than it had been in the past.
The second item was the large electric motor program. We met with Russ Leatherman, the component engineer for motors, to review this program. This emanated back in 2003 from an IMPO report, which identified some, not problems so much, but aging of large electric motors in their environments. They don't last forever, obviously, with their the way they're configured. So Diablo Canyon and most other nuclear plants developed a large motor electric or large electric motor program. And their program follows the IMPO guidelines quite closely. It applies to motors of 4 kilovolts and higher and 150 horsepower and higher, with one exception. That is a 480-volt containment fan cooler unit motors. That's the one exception, but they're included in this as well. We reviewed the program health card, and the program is now a white program, but very, very close to green and headed that way. We looked at the long-term plans for large electric motors, and they looked quite satisfactory. I'd have to say it's an impressive program. It deals with, or the pillars of the program deal with preventive maintenance, and that includes testing, both mechanical as well as electrical testing of motors, predictive maintenance, which includes such analyses as oil analysis, thermography, vibration analysis. They have a program for motor overhauls, a program of scheduled stator rewinds, and they have a well-thought-out list of critical spare motors. So it seems to me they've got their hands around this this program. We then met with Jack Perkis, the new maintenance services director, just to see get his thoughts and whatnot. I will say right now, Jack's going to be on the agenda, I believe, tonight or tomorrow, or this afternoon perhaps. I think he's still here. So I'm going to not steal his thunder, but I will say that he's got some plans for making maintenance more effective, more efficient, for directing more of the work toward the back shifts, he thinks, to help better support operations on those shifts. He wants to drive down the maintenance backlog, which is something I know all of nuclear plants, and, of course, specifically the Diablo Canyon, is working toward. He did make an interesting statement that the outages here are not yet in the big league, quote-unquote, and that they're working toward getting in the big league, and we can ask him more about that later today. He did make a plan. We asked him about the safety culture. Jack had been to, a number of plants, Bill, five or six different plants, I'd say, throughout the country.
Yes.
We asked him how the safety culture here stacked up, and without saying too much, he just said he thought it was good here compared to some good ones and bad ones he's seen at other plants. So we'll have a chance to ask him about that in more detail, perhaps, later today. Next, we looked at the air-operated valve program. Similar to electric motors, IMPO had developed a document in which they had analyzed a number of lost generation, a bunch of lost generation due to failures of air-operated valves. This is back in the mid-90s. Diablo Canyon has a program for that. The committee here has looked at motor-operated valve programs a couple of times, been impressed with those programs. The air-operated valve program is very similar. It's an impressive program. They have an effective procedure for it. They're heavily involved with the with IMPO on this and the IMPO joint owners group. Again, an impressive program. They have an audit coming up, a joint STARS. And STARS is the strategic teaming and resource sharing group that they with four other nuclear plants. A joint STARS and IMPO assessment coming up of the AOV program in March. So we'll want to follow up on that.
Furman, has there been a history of problems with air-operated valves lately?
Lately, yeah. There's always problems with air-operated valves.
There always are, but I mean, is it improving or are things starting to deteriorate with age? What's going on?
Yeah, I meant to mention that. They have a trend of the tests they do on AOVs, and there are no significant problems at Diablo right now with AOVs. There are small things that crop up. There are adjustments that need to be made, but they're not having right now any significant problems or any significant trends due to the program, I think.
How about industry-wide?
I don't know. I would think if all nuclear plants have programs like this, which they should, I know of one other one that does, then that should help solve those problems as well. That's why IMPO did that. It helped solve the problems, and I think it's having a good effect.
From the industry, with the implementation of AOV, air-operated valve programs, different stations are at different levels for putting those into place. And when we had talked to IMPO about that, we had some concerns about ours. Were we doing the right things? And when they looked at ours, they said, we don't necessarily want to come out and look at yours specifically. So they didn't feel like we needed a what they call an assist visit just on air-operated valves. That's why they stepped it back and are looking actually at a group of plants. They're trying to do it more like a fleet assessment. But what I could say in the basically in the industry is that different plants are at different levels, and we're probably more on the leading edge of where we're at with part of our air-operated valve programs.
Next is number five, margin management program. And let me start by saying that when we sat down with Pat Nugent, head of NSSS Engineering, I think, at the time, if I got that right, I think he's at IMPO now, actually.
That's correct.
Pat was in the said, you know, we don't really have a integrated margin management program right now. We're working toward one. We have some pieces of it that they do have an action plan, which they showed us and shared with us, and I'll describe in more detail in the fact-finding report, to define their margins they want to manage. What are they? What should they be? How much margins do we have on various systems? And bring us all together into a single program. So that's really about all I can say about that right now. I think we should follow this and keep tabs on it.
It's a touchy regulatory subject, and it has been for a couple decades now. And there's a whole new era of interest in this at the NRC. And I'm certainly interested in where this shakes out, and I have concerns about where it's going.
Yeah, well, I have to say they've got a pretty good plan, it looks like to me, to go through the various steps and do what has to be done. Some of the system, in fact, all the system engineers in their system health cards do identify various margins of their systems, but it's not the fully comprehensive type of margin management plan that Diablo wants.
Yeah. This is an interesting one because, like you say, there's really a new era coming out of what we're doing with margin management. And when you go out in the industry and look, you know, we talk to IMPO, we talk to others to say, is there a program out there that we ought to model, that we ought to benchmark? And there's none out there. There's pieces at different plants. Different people are doing different pieces of it, and that's why we came back with an action plan to say, okay, what pieces of those do we want to pull together and integrate into a plan? Now, last time we met, we did talk about the NRC inspection on the margin management program, basically, and they did four pilot programs. We were selected. They selected different ones. We were selected because we were our own architect engineers, and the feedback from that inspection was, while they found some issues, they were of low safety significance, and most of them were historical in nature, and those could be addressed. But they found that our design basis was easily accessible, that even operators could go in and access it, which is not typically what you'd see at stations. So they gave us some pretty good marks on how we used our design basis and the accessibility of it, and that we want to take that even farther and have more of an integrated program across the state.
Maybe you can clarify something for me. Was this a part of that overall historical analysis that they did on selected plants? And then they had a big public meeting on it? Was that the same thing or a different
thing? I think we're talking about the same thing. So they did four inspections. They called them high safety significant margin impact type inspections. They did four across the country, and then they did a report out. There was a public meeting probably 2 months ago or so where they came back with their findings and how they're going to change their program going forward. Some of the items that they found was that the assessments were beneficial overall. They felt like it was a good look. They need to look at how they better manage their resources because there were thousands and thousands of contract hours put into it by the NRC, and they just would not be able to manage that for doing a repetitive type inspection for all of the plants.
Was this the one where they had the big open meeting at the Embassy Suites? Or is that a different one?
Yes, so that's the one. We had our own public exit meeting at Embassy Suites in earlier this year, and then they also had a public meeting where they went through and graded themselves basically on how those four assessments went and what they were going to do differently, and that was not local here.
They had a session on it at the American Nuclear Society meeting in June, mm-hmm. which I attended, and PG&E was yes. one of the panelists. And I also attended the open meeting that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It was very clear that all of the plants expended significant resources, right. not just the NRC, but the plants expended a lot of resources on this program. And I gather that there wasn't much positive that came out of it, but for at least one plant, there was a significant negative hit that took place because of arguments about the history of a particular area that was identified.
That's correct.
And at the time, the NRC program manager for that was chairing this panel. Said, oh, that they were planning to do a lot more of these. There was a groan from the audience. But what is the NRC doing? Do you know? Are they doing more?
Yes, so they are changing slightly their inspection plan and to not make it quite as resource impactful. There was seven inspectors for a total of 5 weeks, and then there was additional time outside of that. So they're planning starting in 2006 to conduct periodic assessments. And I can't remember if it's either 2 or 3 years, but every 2 to 3 years they will be at each plant to do this inspection.
Ready to move on? Next item is item number six. The committee has been following for some years now the number of NRC non-cited violations that DCPP has been receiving. We mentioned in our annual report, which is just to be approved, that the trends are increasing substantially over the last year or two. So we decided to take a look at these and talked with Chuck Doherty in Regulatory Services. The applicants compared themselves to other plants in the NRC region, and they are third highest in the region, which is not a particularly bronze medal. It's not what you want to have in the region.
Out of how much competition?
How much?
Third place out of how many?
How many other six?
For the region, there's what?
Take a look at that.
Dozen, okay. 15, 20 plants. So it's for region four.
Yeah, region four.
Third out of 20 is, that's...
Yeah. So, and that's why they did that data, and that's why they say we're looking at this. So we wanted to see what they were doing. I will say that the non-cited violations are considered, these are all green according to NRC, or of very low safety significance. Diablo thinks they need more time to really look at any trends. I would agree with that. We can't see any positive trends yet. However, they do have an improvement program. Each non-cited violation, which they will cover tonight, actually, they cover those each meeting with us, each one gets an apparent cause evaluation and an effectiveness of corrective action evaluation. So they do take those actions to see that it won't happen again. It's part of their corrective action program. They believe that their there are improvements to the corrective action program, particularly the CARB, Corrective Action Review Board, and the Plant Health Committee, which I think we're going to hear about later in this meeting, which will be addressing long-standing equipment issues, will go a long way toward reducing the number of NCVs. They do have, we'll have something else. Bottom line here, they've got a plan. I've not seen any decent results yet. The committee should follow up on this on a fairly regular basis.
I think the only thing I'd like to add to that is I think it's a little unfortunate that the NRC is finding considerably more of these than you are.
Good point.
Something I think you kind of have to look at. You found three, they found 15, at least for year-to-date 05, or perhaps September to date. So that's something you probably want to try to figure out why that's happening.
Definitely. We agree with that. And as part of the NSOC meeting that we had earlier this year, we discussed that as well and what we need to do differently in our quality oversight as well as our own self-identification to make sure that we identify those.
Yes.
It's interesting, though, it seems that in general the NRC finds a lot more of these than the plants do, because all of the plants in this table show very small numbers of self-identified.
That's true.
Which would seem to be the wrong ratio as well.
We discussed that in the meeting as well, and you're right. However, there's always more to the story. And the more to this story is that a lot of the ones that NRC identified, Yellow Canyon had already found in their corrective action program and written an action request for. And they were in the files being corrected. NRC had been looking through there and says, aha, that's a violation. Even though the applicant had already found them. Not all of them, but I think most of them were that way. Bill, I think they mentioned that to us while we were there. So, you know, it's always two sides to the story.
I think it would be proper to track those ones differently. It's much more interesting to find the ones that have not been self-identified. So if indeed most of them were self-identified and there were corrective actions underway, that would seem to me to be a much better situation than finding things that had not been found internally.
That's a good suggestion, and I would recommend to the committee that when tonight and future meetings, that when we hear the report on NRC violations or non-site violations, we ask that question or get them to identify the various ones that they found in advance or ones they didn't find. So who really identified them to start with would be useful information.
And some of these are at such a level that really the question of whether it's a violation or not is a matter of discussion. It's sometimes it's really a matter of interpretation and hard to tell.
Well, NRC makes that distinction.
Well, that's the point.
So it's up to them whether
there's a different viewpoint on either side. And when that happens, there are sometimes different definitions on either side.
I think it would be good to have the information presented as three categories so that you can, the ones that basically Diablo Canyon did not self-identify as being as being a violation, but that they had self-identified and are correcting versus those that were not found by Diablo Canyon at all.
I think that's a useful thing to do as well.
We won't have that for the report out tonight, obviously, but we can definitely talk with Dave Taggart tonight about that. I think Dave's doing it. Or Stan, and talk with them about that and how we might want to do that in the future.
Well, because it would seem that there then the distinction is between whether or not Diablo Canyon classifies it as being the violation. But it's been identified and it's being corrected internally, which is the more important issue.
Well, if Diablo Canyon identifies it initially as a violation, it usually goes in as a licensee event report.
Okay.
So these are different than that.
Okay,
yeah, we have to be very careful here because we also don't want to set it up where the NRC may see that as saying that we're taking that much of an opposing stand from them if we're tracking those separately from how they are viewing them. So I think we need to be a little bit cautious with this. We can sure look at it and see what it takes to put that together. And maybe worth some discussion in a fact-finding mission in the future about...
maybe that would be something that would be good to cover in the fact-finding first before doing anything generic or long-term.
It's a larger issue than just at Diablo Canyon.
Yes.
You find with other NRC inspection reports the same kind of situation exists, and they'll give you credit for it, because you've identified it in your corrective action program. But nevertheless, it still sort of sorts out as being something that falls in the category of what Pierre is talking about.
Are the ones that appear on the bottom of those graphs in red instead of the sandstone color, were LERs written for every one of those?
No,
I wouldn't say that's the case.
No. They're not all LERs. They'll be minor violations of low safety significance, but not a licensee event report.
Right. Well, when some of these were fixed, it sounds to me as if there were things that needed attention, but were not considered by the plant people to be in violation, just something that had to be taken care of. Is that the difference?
I'm not sure what you're saying. Can you state that a little bit differently?
I'm saying in the course of my work, I find things. Mm-hmm. And some of these things we fix or we haven't fixed. And then in reviewing the records later on, the NRC guy says, well, this really was a non-cited violation. You fixed it, but you didn't identify it as a violation. And that's a difference in interpretation, it seems to me.
That might apply in some cases. There's for each one, we probably need to look at it. That's why I'd recommend doing that in a fact finding. We'll be able to get into the details of them.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, if I may, to item number seven. Item number seven was an NRC information notice that came out concerning some electric distribution system failures, I believe at Palo Verde, that perhaps, I'm not sure about this, but perhaps caught the Palo Verde folks by surprise, and that they didn't know when the power failed that they didn't have certain security equipment available. So NRC picked up on that, sent this information notice out to all the nuclear plants to say, look at this, see if it affects you or not. Mm-hmm. And Bill and I were interested in seeing just what the applicant had done with this information notice. Well, they received it. They'd already put it through their operating experience assessment program. And we talked to Gary Corsiglio, I believe his name is pronounced, the security equipment, section system power engineer, I believe that's his term, something like that. And he was very familiar with this bulletin. They sent out a number of emails, and also sent this out and identified it with an action request to get it out in their operating experience assessment program. And it was in the process of working its way through that program. They hadn't really closed it out yet, but they were doing the right things with it. He said in addition that they knew about this. It wouldn't be a surprise to them. They have a separate diesel generator that powers their security systems in addition to the normal single line power coming in. So it was something that wouldn't have surprised them. He also checked with operations and maintenance and security to be sure they knew about it. They did. So it looks like they were doing the right thing with this bulletin.
This is a separate diesel?
That's correct. Dedicated diesel.
Safety grade?
No. Single. Security systems generally have single source power to it. They don't have backup as safety grade equipment. But they do have a dedicated diesel to power apparently the certain aspects of it. And if they lose any power, they have compensatory measures they take to make up for a certain equipment being out. So they've got it pretty well covered. NRC is, I think, not wild about a lot of compensatory measures for security equipment for obvious reasons, so they sent this out to make sure operators were aware of the power sources for their security equipment. So I think, Perry, maybe when you and I go in November, we might just take a look at this and be sure it's been completed through the program. That might be a good thing for us to do.
That sounds like a good idea. This is not unusual. Most facilities have independent diesels with security systems.
Yeah. Or
at least, yeah.
It's more than that.
Well, with all the additional stuff they put out.
We were just talking about how big this diesel was. Do you remember?
Don't know.
It's pretty hefty.
We could find out if you'd like to.
It's pretty hefty, as I recall.
In due time.
All right, the next item, number eight, is the big emergency diesel generators, six of them, the update. And we want to get a general update from the diesel component engineer, I believe she's called, system engineer, actually. Met with her, Christina Kubran, and lessons learned from our Brunswick experience, in which, let's see, what happened at Brunswick there?
Differential relays.
differential relays. They brought the diesel down. Thank you, Bill. And they were familiar with that. They have looked at that, and I think they have plans to make some corrections to their relays. However, in talking with the system engineer, we looked at the system health card, and both Unit 1 and Unit 2 diesels are red as far as system health goes. So we probed into that a little bit more, and that's some unavailability problems and some lube oil leak problems primarily. And they are addressing those problems. However, it's going to take a while to get to address, so it's going to take a while to get the system from red to white to green, or I guess yellow is in there too. So they've got a ways to go yet. They do have a plan. We've looked at that plan. It's documented pretty well. So it's not that the diesels aren't doing their job or couldn't do their job. It's just that their health is not as good as they want it to be. It's not excellent health. So something we should follow.
Just a suggestion, Donna. You may want to comment on the feasibility of being able to make certain repairs and counterbalancing that with the amount of time you want to lose a diesel.
Right, so there's definitely a balance for when we want to take our emergency diesel generators offline. And in fact, going into this outage, this is a major shift for us. Historically, nuclear power plants have taken their diesels out of service during their refueling outages. And then what's happened in the last years is we've looked at that and said, you know, that's really when you need to have your backup power available the most. And so we've undergone a shift where now what we do is look at taking a major diesel outage prior to the refueling outage so that we have our backup power available during the outage. And that's a shift we're using going into 1R13. We can talk to Brad Hines, our outage manager, more about that tomorrow if you'd like. So with that, what we're doing is looking at what's the major work we want to perform and doing that in a major out-of-service window prior to the outage. When you look at it from a risk perspective, it's actually a lower risk by doing it that way. So you do have to balance what kind of equipment and what kind of work you're going to do and at what timing you're going to do it. The issue we're talking about here is coking. So it's a buildup in our lube oil system, and what we found is it's attributed to the configuration of the heater that we have. The lube oil has to stay at a certain temperature so that the diesel can run up and load in a certain amount of time. We have required times for that. And the configuration of our diesel actually has some very localized hot areas, and it causes a very hot temperature, which gets this buildup and causes this buildup in the lube oil system, and so that's what we have to address. The engineers have looked at it and found that really the solution for this is to reorient the heater, and instead of, it's kind of a vertical heater, if you want to look at it that way, where part of the heater elements are exposed more, and many plants have those in a horizontal location to get more even heating across the heater elements. And so we are looking at a modification that'll go into the plants, to each of the heater lube oil, each of the lube oil heaters. So there's three diesels per unit. We're sequencing those out to start next year. So that's the issue that we're dealing with here.
You've got enough diesels so that you can have one out for service.
That's correct.
But not two.
That's correct. What we do is we can take one out for a major out-of-service window prior to the outage. We run three diesels available for each unit.
Now, I might add, even though they've got a plan for this, the bigger question is, not only with the diesels, but other systems as well, is how come the system engineers have tolerated all these failures for such a long period of time, and what are they doing differently now to have a lower tolerance for longstanding issues? They're addressing that with some of their corrective action programs. They've got a non-conformance report out there to address longstanding equipment issues, but I think the committee would be smart to continue to follow this thing just to be sure that things don't creep up on them or not ongoing. I know, for example, the fire protection system, corrosion problems, which we're looking into. I think, Jim, you looked into that or are going to look into it. That was sort of a budget problem that nobody wanted to pay for all this, but it's increased and increased, and it's given the fire protection systems a lower rating than it should have. They have a plan to correct it, but that's my overall concern. I think the committee would be smart to kind of follow this major issue, part of safety culture in a way, to see how it's being addressed.
Don't these various questions that involve budgets, that involve timing, that involve the availability of people and resources, don't these continually get massaged as you go over your quarterly and annual budgets and plans for the coming year. Isn't that a periodic thing?
Right. We will look at that. Really, the issues that we're talking about here came out of the root cause evaluation we did for our longstanding equipment issues, and what we saw with that is that we had some inconsistent ways to get work approved and different ways to get it funded. And so one of the engineers may get approval and go forward on a project, and then later a different group may change that funding. So we didn't have an alignment on our funding and prioritization process. And that's why we're implementing now. We've got the plant health committee. It's one aligned process for reviewing all of the equipment issues that impact the plant, and then having one method for allocating funding to do that. So there is one place to go, and if there are changes made, that's communicated right up front. So we're addressing this misalignment of how we prioritized and allocated funding in the past, and that will address the issues that have been mentioned.
That's focused on funding, but will that also address human resources for that activity and outage time or downtime of systems and so on?
All that has to be looked at in order to be able to schedule that work. So all of that, through that process and through our outage readiness processes, that will address.
But is that pulled together under a budget, the top line is budget, and everything feeds into that?
Well, how we go through that is by ensuring that the proper funds are allocated for the work. And part of this plant health process has a, it's called the Project Review Committee, and they're the ones that are going to allocate the funds. And so we'll look at it, and based on priority ranking of the significance of the issues, we'll allocate the funds for that, and we'll project that out. So not only are we doing it for a one-year look ahead, but we're also looking at laying out our own internal 5- and 10-year plans.
It sounds like the buck stops here when it comes to the money.
That's correct.
And in terms of people and positions, who are the final sign-offs on that?
Okay. So from the Plant Health Committee process, Jim Becker, our station director and vice president of operations, is the chair of that. For our Project Review Committee, which is the one that allocates the funds for that, Dave Oatley, our station general manager, is the chairman for that.
Thank you.
I would like to make just one more comment, perhaps, before we leave this. You, I'm sure, will recall part of the conversation we had with, in this case, I guess, three system engineers or three people involved in this particular issue. There was a bit of a discovery that you have some hidden relays that don't actually show themselves unless one knows where they are, and that's kind of the tribal history syndrome. The gent that we spoke with has been here a considerable period of time, so he knew exactly where they were. As a result of questions as to why others who were qualified to work on this particular system had no idea of their location, I raised the issue of training. Is there a training issue involved here? And I think the acknowledgement was yes, there probably was. So I would only encourage that someone take a look and make sure that the application of the location of these has been factored into somebody's training program so that others beyond this individual know where they are. That cost you some time, by the way,
yeah,
as a result of the lack of knowledge there.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, and training and procedures. I'm not sure it's clear the procedures either, Bill.
Yeah, the procedure was one issue, but even with the procedure in your hand, if you don't know where it is, that's not very that helpful.
All right. Moving on. Bill?
Yes, sir.
Is that it?
Fine.
We looked at a system. You know, we like to look at systems periodically. We looked at the auxiliary saltwater system with Joe Anastasio, the system engineer. Took a tour of the system with him down to the intake, or a lot of parts of the system. Bottom line there is, on the system health report, health card, unit one version of the system is white because they have some leaks and things they're working on at some flanges. Nothing major, but enough to drive the system from green to white. Unit two is green. So system is relatively in good health, I would say. Joe seems to be on top of the system. He's been system engineer for a long time.
Yes.
He's kind of a nuts and bolts and a very practical-minded guy, I would say. So, no, I'm not worried about that system particularly.
That's not going to be something that gets forgotten when he retires, is it?
I don't know, but I hope they would have a plan to, for a good turnover. Next, we observed some operator training on the plant simulator. Spent about an hour looking at a crew in training. Basically, they were working through a 75% power full load rejection on the simulator, and without beating it to death, quite frankly, I thought they did a good job. They were very professional, good three-way communication, et cetera, and they did a pretty good little critique afterward. Bill, I'm not sure how much more I can say about that.
No, I want to comment that I found that the critique was very critical. I think they were all critical of each other, and which is what you want. So I would say that was well done.
Number 11, we looked at an update on operator fitness and no solo trends. No solo means that certain operators might not pass their physical requirements and be declared by the site medical director no solo, or in other words, they cannot work alone out of the plant. The trends look pretty good here, actually. We've looked at this before, and in January of 2002, they had 18 no solos. January of 2004, they had 14 no solos. Now they have 10. So that's a trend in the right direction. That means the operators are getting healthier. However, there's always an asterisk here, and that is that some managers are also included in no solo, and some of them may not be in good health. And that sort of clouds the issue because they're not actually out in the plant necessarily turning valves and pushing buttons and things. But the good news is it's a good trend. Dr. Giorgio, the site medical director part-time, didn't talk to him exactly, but it was reported that he felt the operator fitness level was improving, according to Gary Anderson, assistant operating manager who we talked with. So I think things are getting better there. I'm not worried about it. Bill, I don't think you are either, particularly. It sounded pretty good.
No, I thought it was, I was quite impressed. I thought things were going quite well.
And they're doing some hiring to replace attrition and whatnot. Looks like they're pretty well on top of it. That's the last slide of my report. On item 12 was a meeting that Bill had with Dave Oatley. Bill, I don't know what you want to say about that. But
No, other than just a discussion relative to his views on the performance of the plant and sharing some of my views as well.
All right. That concludes my report. Questions or comments?
Anything else? Great. Berman, thank you very much. Sheila, do you have a report?
No, I was not involved in the fact findings since the last public meeting, so I have nothing to report.
Oh, let me add to my report. The report, my fact finding meeting report, is in progress. I should have that to Bill for first review in a couple of weeks, and then after I get his comments, I'll put it together, and sometime during end of this month, early November, I'll have it available to all the committee for review, and we'll hope to approve it at the next meeting.
Good. Yeah, and Jim, I think the lack of electric power may have delayed his report somewhat, but yeah, you'll talk about that. Yeah. Sheila, do you have anything in the works?
I know,
fact findings.
It should have been like the dog ate the report.
I have no fact finding in the works.
Okay. Okay, Jim, you're up.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to report on two fact-finding reports as since last public meeting. First one was July the 20th, 21st, with Dave Rothman and myself. First day we attended the NSOC meeting here on site, which overall I thought was a good meeting. They presently have four external members as a member of NSOC. Three of them were there, one of them was not able to attend. And certainly I guess that happens sometimes. Overall, I think the committees are being very effective in looking at particular areas. I have one concern about these committees, though, Donna, is that if these committee members, especially the external members, all get so involved in looking into the problems and making recommendations, are they still going to be independent to look at those corrective actions really resolve that? I don't know how you answer to that, but I guess on NSOC that I've been on in the past, the NSOC doesn't get as involved in making recommendations how to solve problems. Now, I think the work they're doing and the attention they're giving to the problems is very good, but that's just a concern I have about. Bill, you've been on NSOC before too. What, you have any concern on that?
Well, I think the very nature of these committees and the longevity of individuals serving on them can lend themselves to being somewhat less independent as time goes on. So I don't disagree with what you're saying. On the other hand, I don't know that there's necessarily a solid virtue associated with getting to the point where a request or a suggestion or a recommendation becomes a demand, and that can happen. And I think that's something you probably have to be quite cautious of. But by and large, I think an emphatic recommendation is something you're seeking. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't want to have a committee to begin with. I think it's a question of the individuals serving on the committee to make sure that they're not so involved in what it is they're suggesting or recommending to you that it becomes a gun to the head. And that's, I think, a situation that you have to seek when you select people and observe how they perform for you.
I think there's two points of discussion there. The first is that we do sometimes receive suggestions from the off-site members. Typically, what we end up doing with that is they may have seen something differently at another station that they've been at. And so instead of just adopting that, what we'll do is take that and use that as benchmarking. We'll look at that, the input that they give us, and then we'll go out and benchmark other stations as well and find out if there's other ways of doing business before we adopt a particular way of going about it. And then we'll review that with them when they return to say, this is what we've looked at and this is the direction we're going. So I think from that point, we may not be just taking what they're giving us and putting it into place. And the other point of it is we do look at how long some of the members are on that committee, and we will rotate them out. We think it's important to keep a fresh perspective in. So I know talking with Dave just a few weeks ago, looking at how long different members have been on the committee and where we may need to make changes there. So we do assess that as well.
I won't mention any names, but you've got some that's been there a long time.
Yes, we do. We'll be working on that.
Yeah, and I think I've heard the same things from them sometimes, which makes me think that maybe some of the plant people don't take them as seriously as they well, maybe they're treating them properly. I don't know. But I hear some broken records sometimes.
But overall, I think the NSOC has improved their performance over the last 3 or 4 years. So I think they're heading more in the right direction, doing a better job. And I'll mention this as a caution. Just to be sure that whenever they get so involved that they are continuing to remain independent. But I think the NSOC meeting is also a very good meeting for the members of this committee to attend. You get a really good perspective of what else happened at the plant in one day and what they're doing about it. So I think we should continue to attend as many of the NSOC meetings as we could.
What is the process for selecting members for NSOC?
I'm not familiar with how we go about doing that here at Diablo. Typically what a station will do is look at areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. We do break up the committee into subcommittees. Similarly, what we do here is you go out and you look at certain areas, and we'll do that as well. And so we'll look at how long somebody has been in that position, and we'll look for areas of expertise and look for independence. We try to keep a balance between somebody who's had some past regulatory oversight from NRC perspective or other individuals who have been perhaps positions throughout the industry in plants we may not have associated directly with so that they can provide independence. We try to balance the composition from kind of a regulatory oversight, from plant knowledge, and from experience. I would say that we probably do the same thing here, although I've not been involved with the selection process here yet.
I find the subcommittee reports more valuable than the discussion during the meeting, because I think the subcommittee reports usually are pretty good. And that depends on who the individuals are, just like it is in any kind of a subcommittee situation. Does Diablo Canyon have plant personnel that serve on such committees at other plants?
Yes, so we do have representatives that are on nuclear oversight committees for other stations.
Do you know offhand how many? A few? A lot?
I know just one I can think of right off the top of my head, which is our operations services director. He serves on the Palo Verde Nuclear Safety Oversight Committee, and I can't tell you right now if there's others. I'd have to go back and look.
Is there any barrier to that person giving feedback back here on the problems that other plants have? Because sometimes that's how you learn. You're supposed to learn from observations of other plants, but are there any barriers when you serve on an NSOC with sharing information?
Not sure that I understand the question. You mean that if that person, that director, is participating in the committee for another plant to bring back what they've learned? I've not seen any concerns with that. This director, in fact, goes through a debrief when he returns from his visits, from some of the things that he's seen and how we may need to learn from that here at Diablo. So I think it's been very healthy because it gives another perspective, and he shares that with the station.
Good. You might mention that each one of these subcommittees has an external member of the NSOC on that subcommittee too. The next day we had some presentations by PG&E and some various items here. The first one was overall performance overview by Bruce.
Before you leave the NSOC meeting, I do have a question.
Okay.
Are you leaving the NSOC meeting?
No, go ahead, sure.
Okay, thank you. How was the meeting structured? Who facilitated that NSOC meeting?
The chairman of the committee, and I think that particular one, Donna, was...
That's correct. David Oatley is
David
the chairman
is.
For the committee, and he was unable to be there at that committee, so I was the chairman for that committee meeting.
But if he had been there, he would have chaired the session
That's
and managed
correct.
The interaction.
That's correct.
Yep.
Well, so you bring up a good topic there. There's some committees like this and other utilities that use an external member as a facilitator or chairman of that. PG&E does not. So that's a mixed opinion as to whether it should be an interim member or an external member who should be chairman of the NSOC. And we've talked about that, I guess.
Yes, we
about.
Have.
Okay, the next day is that we had the PG&E presentations. The first item was Bruce Terrell, who supervises the corrective action program. He discussed a lot of things. So he talked about the corrective action program, talked about root cause analysis, parent cause analysis, plant trending, ART, which is the action request team, how they review things, and then he also talked about the corrective action review board, what they made up and how they do. We then had a presentation on 1R13 outage planning and goals. I guess one of the significant items in 1R13 is this is the year for the 10-year reactor vessel inspection. So that would be quite a chore there. They'll have to do that. Dave Rawson met with one of the vice presidents. Was that Jim Becker that day, or was it Don?
I think it was with Don. My recollection
yes,
is
we met
during that fact. I mean,
that's correct.
These begin to swim together after a while.
I didn't meet you.
We had a meeting that day.
Yes.
Next was a presentation on change management and organizational development. And then the next one, Ardelia Daniels gave us a presentation on organization improvement program. And I, from her presentation and her background and all, I think PG&E needs to be committed to being able to bring her in to assist y'all in this development. I think she can do a good job for y'all.
Thank you.
Let's go back up one to that change management discussion.
Okay.
That was meeting with Pierre Dubé.
Right.
And we probably had 50 minutes discussions about what he was doing, what he was involved with, what initiatives were going on at the plant, and he answered a lot of questions, as I recall, and had a good feel for what he has observed since he's been at Diablo Canyon, and some observations from his previous employment in this and other industries. I came away with the idea that he was kind of an internal consultant, helping people put together their implementation plans or work plans for initiatives that they were undertaking. And I was thinking about this whole question about, like we just talked about, where these things come together within the plant. And in general, his area of where he interacts with individuals is on their own plans. They've got a program that they're going to do. They've got a budget. They've got goals. They've got resources to put together, people to put together, and organizational changes to make it happen sometimes, but it's that individual's responsibility. And yet they needed assistance in planning, in the concepts of planning, and the things they were going to do, but it didn't go beyond their area of responsibility. Am I on target on that?
Well, Pierre helps us in many ways, and I think when we look at a change, there are some changes that will be just within a, if you want to call it a department, but there's other changes that will impact others throughout the station. And what I hear you talking about would typically be those that may be very smaller in a department, so it's something that's just impacting maintenance.
Perhaps. Yeah, I think I misspoke on that because I didn't include where that plan impacts or is involved with other areas of the operation.
Right.
Because that's an integral part of that planning process.
Right.
And I left that out of what I said. And he did talk about that.
Right. And so what he'll do is help us build that plan. So we'll have an owner who's going to lead the change, and he can come in and help go through what does that change management look like. And so there's some nuts and bolts of change, and there's the people side of change, and there's communication side of change, and then how do we know everybody that it impacts? And he helps go through to make sure that those change plans factor in all of those pieces. And then depending on how broad that change is, we'll review that in different settings. So those items that come out of our performance plan, I know I've been asked to talk a little bit about transformation, how we handle that. We'll talk about that later this evening. But when we look at those, then the officers and directors actually review those plans at our weekly officer-director meeting. So there's some different levels of review depending on how complex the change is.
Good.
Donna, other than review, where are the big changes actually connected and managed? In Dubay's shop?
So the way that we do that is through our performance plan, and we review that in our officer and director meeting. So it's really the officers and directors that own that and look for that interface. And we'll also do that through meetings that we'll have that will just focus on where we're headed with our performance plan. So that's what we use to document and capture the key changes we're making for the station and how we look at those from impacts and interfaces.
Are there minutes to those meetings?
We capture action items coming out of that. I don't know that we capture specific minutes for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The last item we discussed was the pipe corrosion, actually corrosion in not only the pipe, but also the tanks and the fire protection system. They've developed two action plans that have been approved by management in the budget. They're going to start in 2R13 on some of the corrective action, and then 1R14 and 2R14 to finish those up. So it looks like that they're going to start working on those and get those done.
The concern was that they not be put off too long, because even though they aren't the most exciting programs, they can bite you. And they had been postponed in the past. And, you know, the program guy is saying, well, gee, you know, I thought I made a good case, but we didn't get the funding this year. It certainly appeared that he was rising gradually to the top of the line.
You know, unfortunately, systems that don't affect plant reliability, I mean, that's there in case of a fire, but it doesn't affect reliability, or it's not a safety-related system, a lot of times they don't get the same priorities in budget that other things get, but they need to get those priorities. That's not uncommon for systems like that not to get the top priorities. And that's all I had. I apologize for not having a report to you to hand out.
Before you leave this one, I'd like to go back to the organizational improvement program. Other than talking to Adelia, I didn't hear what you learned, and I'd like to know a little bit about that. And also, as I understand it, there's going to be a Department for Performance Improvement. Did you learn anything about that?
What?
Apparently not.
Yeah,
no. I don't remember that being discussed.
She in general just talked about her background, what she's doing. She didn't go into a lot of details.
Okay, so there wasn't really a discussion of a performance improvement program. There was a discussion with Adelia about what she was doing to improve performance.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Is that your recollection, too?
Yeah. Fine.
As I say, I'm sorry I didn't have the report ready at this time. But whenever I was working on the report, whenever we were ordered forced evacuation, and my wife and I had a choice of what to take with us, and the information on this did not get taken with us. Now, of course. This is a meeting we had on September the 7th and 8th, Per Peterson and myself here. For 2 days. On the first day, we had a very interesting meeting with three new engineers here who had been here over a year, 2 years here at Diablo Canyon, and a very frank and open discussion with them about their background, what they've done at Diablo Canyon, what's been their challenges, what they think about the nuclear industry, what they think about the future. And it was just a good interchange of information. And I think Dr. Peterson was getting a lot of that for his university up there, too. So, Perry, you got anything you want to say about that?
I thought that, first of all, I was quite impressed with the positive attitude that they held about their positions, the level of enthusiasm that they had. They were also appreciative of the efforts that PG&E has made to provide mentoring and professional development. Dug in a little bit to check and see whether they thought that there were, say, silly requirements or other things, particularly around safety, that perhaps they wouldn't want to take seriously. And they all felt that the safety requirements that they're faced with all made sense and were logical. And I find that to be in contrast to what you find, for example, at the DOE, National Laboratories, where there's a lot of cynicism around safety, simply because a lot of things that are being done or are required, quite frankly, are just not rational when you look at them in detail. And, of course, that generates a bad environment, because some of the requirements are important when you add in ones that are silly, such as you know, office workers are not allowed in DOE office buildings to nail in picture hooks for safety reasons, so that they can't hang their own pictures when they move offices. This is the sort of thing that does generate bad attitudes. So overall, I was
on a safety basis.
Yes. It's a labor thing, I'm pretty sure, but that's what I was told. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went and visited a colleague. He had all of his pictures sitting on the floor. He was waiting because he'd been told that for safety reasons he was not permitted to hang the pictures himself.
Is it a union town?
That too, yeah. The one thing, though, I did note is that they also had very positive reaction to the hiring process, where they were brought in as a class. And they worked together, and that way they had peers who were in the same process. It was more reminiscent of being in school. And my understanding is that has not happened the last year or two, and it seems to have such a beneficial effect that this approach of bringing in new engineers as a group seems to be the best way to do hiring. And so I'd be curious, actually, to find out what the future plans are going to be in this area around hiring piecemeal versus in groups.
Yeah, we agree that bringing them in as a group gives them an opportunity to have individuals that they can relate to, share experiences with, and so that's very positive. We haven't had the need to bring in a large amount of engineers at this point, and so part of our workforce planning is that we're projecting out when we would expect to bring in the next group that's out another year or two, and so we're looking at that. And when we're ready to bring in another group, we will do it at one time, similar to what we did with that, because there was a lot of positive lessons learned from that experience. So we'll definitely do it that way.
They were also very appreciative of the training program where they were assigned to a particular group for a period of time and then rotated into like three different groups. So really got to know the organization here at Iowa Canyon. And then also they were used during outages. That gave them a lot of new experience too. So they were very complimentary of the training program, how they were brought into the job.
And this sort of mentoring is also important. Another thing that we did during the meeting was to get some opportunities to find out how much younger engineers, how much they're familiar with the history of the plant. And in fact, you can find significant gaps where they're not aware that things were done differently in the past. I had some questions related, for example, to what Diablo Canyon did in response to the millstone problems of the early 90s. And in fact, this was known by senior engineers, but not by the younger ones. And This is, of course, something that's difficult to remedy and is of concern because you're beginning to lose a lot of the corporate knowledge, I think, already. And there's clear evidence that a lot of things that the plant went through in the 80s and the early 90s are not known by the young people that you brought in.
The next presentation was on the QVE quality verification assessment of the plant performance. Dave Taggart talked about the latest QPAR and what they've been doing. Overall, I think they're doing a good job in identifying problems. They certainly think the plant is improving. It has a ways to go. It still needs to go there. The question we talked at length is that they have been identifying some of these outstanding problems for quite a while. That didn't get fixed. We really pushed it home. Why the problems did not get fixed that they've identified. He took some of the responsibility for not pushing as hard as they should have pushed to. We had a presentation on the 1R13 outage safety plan. The plan had not been completed and approved yet. It's pretty much the same outage safety plan as they've had in the past. They're going to do a hot mid loop this time, so that will be some difference there.
Jim, what was the difference between the discussion you had in September and the one we had back in July on the 1R13?
In July, we talked about what they were going to actually do for 1R13, the plan, the work that was going to be done. This time, we were just talking about the safety plan, essentially.
Was there really a difference in the tone of the discussion?
Well,
in what you got into?
Well, their safety plan is how they manage work during the outage. If they changed it, what's the safety implications? He did not go into the details that he did with us.
Not the overall plan
work,
per
right.
se. Okay.
Right.
Okay, I understand.
We had a presentation on the cause analysis of the two NRC cross-cutting issues, the human performance and the corrective action program. And then Jim Becker explained, I guess it's the new committee, management review committee. Has that taken place yet?
No, the management review committee will actually start. The first one will be in February using the data from January. So we've just started an initial rollout, kind of the preview with leadership team to get them familiar with it. We're doing some of the work behind the scenes, and we'll be more active in that after the outage.
Yeah, that's what he told us. That it wasn't in effect at that time. It was sometime after.
What is the function of this committee?
I'll be talking more about that tomorrow.
Fair enough.
Did you say anything about the cross-cutting issue, or did we cover all that?
I said we had him talk about the cause analysis of those two issues.
No, did they draw any conclusions?
Well, is uh,
Was that like a root cause analysis, Jim?
It's a root cause
or
analysis.
Or apparent cause analysis.
It was the one that they'd done quite some time ago. Went to the two NRC crossbed initiatives. And to sort of review how they did it, the process they used for doing that.
Was that before the plant got the letter from the NRC removing the cross-cutting issue, or was it still in force? You remember? Was the regulatory issue still?
One of them had been removed.
Well, yeah, one of
them. Human performance had, but corrective action had not at that time.
The particular one on that remained and that was commented on by Furman a moment ago was still in force up until some date.
August 30th.
August 30th.
Yeah, right.
So it was gone too by the time they had the meeting.
Well, they may not have received the letter. You probably got the phone call.
Yeah,
I think they just received the letter. We got a copy of that letter that day, right.
Hey, I think the root cause analysis that PG&E did probably was,
it was last year.
Before either cross-cutting issue was eliminated.
Yeah.
That's the question you were just asking.
And I guess where I was going with the question, maybe it's irrelevant, but was in removing the cross-cutting issue, did they say anything about the correctness or relevance of the analysis that the plant made? Or did they just say, okay, the issue's gone?
You mean the NRC?
I don't remember seeing the letter. It may have come.
The NRC letter?
I didn't see it.
I have the letter.
Well, if you look at the letter, at least the second one, it doesn't really come out and say that explicitly. It talks about the issue, but the NRC letter, and we got a copy of it in one of our packages.
It's
here's a copy there.
Listing letter. Although it doesn't actually say it.
PG&E actually had to call NRC and talk with them about that, and NRC told them over the phone, I think, Donna, if this is correct, that yes, we have removed the cross-cutting issue on corrective action. But it doesn't say so explicitly in that letter.
No,
it leads up to that statement, but
correct.
It didn't quite get there.
That's right.
So. It was a little vague, so we did talk to them personally to make sure we understood their position.
You need
there.
A little three-way communication here.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Any more questions then?
No.
Okay, good. Jim had a presentation on the self-assessment program status.
I'm sorry, just to recapitulate, I'd seen this letter. I didn't know what it was about.
Right, so they sent out the end-of-cycle assessment letter and then the mid-cycle assessment letter, and this was their mid-cycle assessment letter.
Was there ever any conclusion on what the root cause of the cross-cutting issues was? I mean, they did a root cause analysis. What was the root cause?
Yes, I'm not ready to go right through those, but
okay.
We could definitely do that. And I think we've actually talked about those previously. We really got into the line ownership of, in fact, both of those areas, and we can definitely go through what actions we took that led to the removal of the cross-cutting issue.
Yeah, I think we
one of the notes I have here is management oversight and enforcement, one of the major issues.
We talked about the things that were in progress and the things that you decided to do, but you didn't have feedback from the NRC about, yeah, this is great, that solves a problem. You didn't have any feedback at that time, at the time we talked about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, we're talking about self-assessment program status, what they've done to improve that on their self-assessment, how they're trying to encourage the various departments to do more self-assessment on themselves, how many they plan to do this year, and also an action plan, looking at benchmarking other plants on their self-assessment.
Jim, did you look into the program health for the self-assessment program? Did you get into the program health? And what is it?
No, we didn't do that. We did not.
Right. Does that program have a health card, or don't all the programs have a health status, Donna?
It doesn't have what we would call a health card. We usually use that for engineering programs. But what we do with self-assessments is monthly we review those at our performance improvement board. So we look at corrective action, benchmarking, self-assessment, and human performance. And we review the different metrics that we have for each of those programs and look at what the trends are and discuss that with it goes from managers, officers, and directors.
I guess what I'm getting at, as a program, the self-assessment program has a program owner, I think.
Yes.
As do most of your programs. And then, but don't you calculate quarterly or simply a program health, green, yellow, white?
Right. We don't roll those up to one indicator. So what we'll use is a number of metrics, the concern being if you roll it up too high, does it give you an accurate picture of it? So that's why we choose to look at several pieces of it. So are you planning self-assessments? Are you conducting them on time? Are you implementing the recommendations that you have from those self-assessments? How long does it take to implement those recommendations? So those are some of the metrics that we review monthly.
I've seen those. Okay. So there's no roll-up, for example.
That's correct.
The next item we had was the review of the models and codes for the plant simulator. I guess during the December of 04 emergency exercise that Perry and Furman were at, I guess the simulator crashed on them, and we were interested in how they recovered it so quickly. And the reason they recovered it so quickly, they've had that problem in the past, and so they knew exactly what to do to recover the program. I guess when they're running an emergency exercise, they really are going beyond the design basis of the simulator. And so the simulator really cannot handle all of what they're doing. Herman, Perry, going to add anything to that?
Yes. Basically, anybody who's ever worked with simulation models knows that they crash frequently due to various problems that will crop up with the models. And that also happens on the simulator that they're using now. It has a very well-known kernel to it, which is the RELAP code. That is more of a research tool and modeling tool than it is something that will always be stable. So it was actually a very positive thing to see that they had a sufficiently good detailed understanding that they were able to reboot and to get the thing to work properly when it had crashed. Of course, it would have affected the whole progression of the exercise if they'd been unable to get the simulator to work subsequently. I was pleased to find that they had a fairly strong and basic understanding of what the tool was, how it's supposed to work, and how to make it work properly in this sort of setting. It's not surprising that you'd see that sort of thing happening, but being able to respond that quickly is good. It shows a lot of familiarity with the tool.
Just as an update on that, when we did, Bill and I did our September 21st fact-finding, we did observe the operators running on the simulator, and I asked the training manager back there about this problem, and he said it had been corrected. This particular RELAP part of the code had been corrected, he said. So,
Oftentimes these are things that are associated with the way that you've set up the problem and done the nodalization. And so these are things that you can fix by adjusting parameters so that you don't get into the same types of trouble.
Dr. Peterson had a meeting with Donna, the management meeting that we always have with each one of our meetings. The next item is the spent fuel pool and system walk down. The system health for the system for the spent fuel pool is all green, which is the right way to go. And then we had a discussion on the heat exchangers and walked down through all the heat exchangers and pumps. And got a very good tour of the spent fuel pool, I thought. Went up on the top floor and saw where they go up, install the temporary racks there. Overall, I think it was a good presentation and a good walk down to see where it's located. We went to the outside, see where it's located, and see the 5 to 6 foot cement walls there for the pool and all of the protection it has, and mainly the elevation of where it's located.
Jim, did you go over the system health card with the system engineer, and can you say what the system health is?
He went over that, and like I said, all of it was green. He had one pump that had a small leak to it, really, but otherwise it was all in good shape. Steve Chestnut gave us a presentation on the engineering reorganization that they have effected here at the plant, quite a bit of reorganization. And then the maintenance people gave us an implementation on the online maintenance, discussed on what they do, what is included in online maintenance. And they will not consider anything to do online maintenance that takes more than 50% of the allowed time in the tech spec for their plant. But they don't want to have to. I think, if they don't get it completed in time. So that's a pretty conservative measure they're taking there.
Jerry, I didn't understand that. Say it again.
Okay, tech specs allows you to take a certain instrumentation out for 48 hours, 72 hours, yep, or a week. whenever they plan to take that out, which they're allowed to do, they plan the schedule, how long it's going to take them to do that job. If the job takes more than 50% of that time, then they're not going to do it.
If the job plans out it more than 50% of the time. So they want a safety.
They have to slack in if they need it.
They want a margin of 100%.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. What's the track record? Are they pretty good at planning these amounts of time? Are they usually done in less than 50% of the time? Or does it vary all over the map? Did they talk about that?
No, they really talked about what they use as guidelines to do that. They didn't talk about particulars of what they've done in the past.
We call those our maintenance outage windows, and so we talked about how we schedule them, and now we're talking about the performance of them. Definitely something if you want to look at a future fact-finding. What I can tell you is that we've put a lot of emphasis in that into how we schedule those out and then also how we execute those. We've put in place what we call maintenance outage window leaders, and so for each shift, if it's going to go multiple shifts, each shift has a leader that oversees the work done. And with the changes we've implemented over the last 6 to 8 months, we've been actually able to show how we've brought our maintenance outage window times in per the schedule. So definitely we've made some changes in that area, and we're definitely executing to schedule at this point.
And apparently planning better.
Definitely. Some areas we've had some emergent work that's come up, but we've been able to address those, and having the MOW leader, the maintenance outage window leader there, has really helped us provide the right focus to get that taken care of.
Jim, last time we looked at that, PG&E was looking to switch from their calculational tool to determine the risk factors from what's called ORAM Sentinel program to one called Safety Monitor program to assess the risk and taking equipment out for online maintenance. Have they made that switch over yet, did they say?
I guess we didn't discuss that.
Okay. Don, do you know?
No, I don't know where that is, and that's something that we can follow up on.
We'll follow on fact-finding. I think Pierre and I might do that next month, but I'm just curious what steps. Okay.
The last presentation was another presentation by Rita Daniels on what she's doing in the area of human performance. I thought it'd be good for Dr. Peterson to hear from her directly, and we were able to schedule her to come in and do that.
I should say that I found that to be very helpful to meet with her. For me, it was educational because this is not an area where I have background or experience, and she was able to provide some relatively straightforward examples that allowed me to much better understand what the goals are for human performance and how one achieves those goals. So she's clearly a really outstanding asset to the company, just because she can talk to people like me and explain these things. That's takes a lot of skill to be able to do that.
And there's a big advantage of having a meeting like that at fact finding. You can really get a lot more into details at a meeting like that than you can in a public meeting, too. Yeah. So big advantage of doing it at fact finding.
Jim, can I back up to your second item, QV assessment? I think I heard you say at the end of your talk there that there were some concerns about QV not pushing hard enough on issues they raise to get resolution. Now, is that a significant problem?
Well, as you well know, QPAR for the last 2 or 3 years have been identifying problems on equipment availability, on recurring problems, and sometimes it seems so. They continue that way.
And she's actually able to
and right, but I'm saying, are they not getting addressed, these problems?
I think maybe the reorganization they have now may improve that, whereas they're reporting directly to Dave Upton now.
Right.
And I think Dave Taggart admitted that maybe sometimes they would bring up all these issues, but maybe they did not push them as far as they should have pushed them.
And they're being much more demanding in some cases when there's issues that are raised. They require a 30-day turnaround on that, which is appropriate. And so at that point, the director or assigned manager is required to assess where we're at and provide updates and report backs to them. And that's where we need to be. So they are definitely being much more demanding since that kind of feedback has come back to them.
Well, I think over the period of time, they've been doing a good job identifying problems. They just were not getting addressed. I think it was not a lack of not knowing about the problem.
Whose job is it to push on those problems? Is it QV's, or is it the manager, or, in, you know, where does that stand?
Well, they shouldn't have to push on the problem. So what we're also seeing is a shift in leadership where those kinds of issues are brought up, that we take those issues and we own them, and we want to be the ones to say, we figured out what it is, and here's what we're doing differently. You've heard a lot so far about, you know, we've reviewed action plans, so it's our desire that we look at it, we figure out what we need to do, what actions do we need to put in place, and then we follow that up so that we can close those issues out. So definitely it needs to be line ownership of it and saying we own what that issue is and we want to fix it and we want to get it behind us, and that's where we're going.
Is that happening?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And that was one of the problems of the self-assessment program. I think the line organizations did not own the self-assessment program where they should.
Right.
That's why it wasn't affecting the children. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Dave, I have not a question on that. I've got a handout. I think now is a good time to give it. It's just a list of all our fact findings this reporting period and public meeting items. It's just the list of the agenda items we covered. FYI, no action needed on it right now.
Okay. While we're passing this along, Rob?
Just a couple items,
to
touch on. One, I wanted to go back. I briefly had mentioned when we talked about under financial matters, I mentioned that the cost of the audit, I thought it was $7,500. It's actually $5,900. I rechecked on that. Also, when we were talking about the financial matters, I mentioned the activity relative to ongoing and impending revision to attachment A to appendix C. These all go back to the documents that created the committee back in the order back in 1989, with the revision that was made in 1997, where all of that was put aside when they revised the status of the rate base for Diablo Canyon. But the committee continued, and then, of course, the revisions that came out through the process, the 2003 rate case and the decision that came back out last year, it has left a lot of confusions. You know, some things have fallen off on the side, and so we've provided you with the intent and the effort is to make sure that these things that have been really the charter and the basis upon which the committee has operated, that they continue and we try to keep them in one place, have been followed, and sort of inadvertently some of them have fallen out and others need to be included back in and specified, particularly from last year's decision, the appointment process. So as I indicated, we've been working with PG&E's attorneys, Jennifer Post in particular, and the attorneys for the PUC, representatives from the governor's office, the Energy Commission, and everyone is in agreement that this all needs to be done. It's just been a matter of trying to get input from everybody and then get back together. And so that process will be continuing, and I'll keep you informed. What we do with it when we finally come to an agreement is to figure out how we run it back through the PUC. Truman Burns has indicated he has one thought about it, and the governor's office has a different thought. So the actual process we haven't specifically determined yet as well.
And where does the local groups, where do they stand on that?
They're also part of the process. They've been they have been at the Rochelle on behalf of the Mothers for Peace, and she also represents TURN, has also has been involved in all of these discussions and meetings.
Well, is this draft a consensus including them?
I believe it is. We had the last input we've had to these revisions as we've put this together, and Bob Rathy has done the yeoman's work of trying to gather everything. The comments have been sent back and forth. The latest comments we've received have been from PG&E and from the PUC. Excuse me, from the Energy Commission, their attorneys. And so, but I think it's generally a consensus item that everyone is proceeding with.
Okay. So once you can get the parties together, there will be a vote of acceptance? Is that the...
There will, but then it still needs, you know, it still requires some official action by the PUC, and exactly how that needs to be determined. We haven't figured out what the process is, whether you reopen some... it'll require some discussion with the ALJ probably to determine how they want to proceed.
It can't just be a revised appendix that is voted on and stuck into the act?
There has to be some formal approval at the PUC, and that's the as they say, that kind of formal step. We haven't quite figured out what's the best way and most expeditious way.
So that means that, assuming that this gets done, then the next appointment that comes up in the future will be done under that.
Well, that's the goal. Of course, the decision that came out last year had specific orders with regard to how the appointment process is to proceed, and that's set forth in here. We've set forth those provisions in this draft, The intent is that's the way the process will be followed. The next appointment, of course, is Bill's by the Energy Commission next June. So we're hoping to have it all in place. You know, the goal was to have this all in place in January of this year, and so now it looks like maybe January of next year. A couple other items just to touch on. I mentioned, and it's probably best could have fallen under our discussion about outreach. I did want to report that Bob's given me a note that the website, if you haven't visited it recently, it's been updated with a new look and additional links. We have links to the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, the NRC, and the IAEA on the website, and also a new area for press releases. And we've included the press. We started with that initial press release that we sent out. It's in your packet about Dr. Clough's presentation. And we've also we have added, Bob, here's the note, he did add a hyperlink to the commonly used acronyms, so that's been done. And then relative to the activities, I thought it was interesting, we get a report. I'm not very familiar with how websites work, but there is you get an activity report for your website. So I thought just briefly, this touch for you is kind of interesting, of the statistics. The visits are defined as the approximate number of actual individual visitors. In June of 2000, we had 967. June of last year, 1,400. June of this year, 2,556. The issue of hits. Hits are defined the total number of files requested from the server. In June of 2003, it was 6,200. Last year in June, it was 10,600. This year, it was 13,900. So you can see an amazing... And then further interest is, I guess, then bytes tells the amount of information transferred in filling requests for hits. And in 2003, it was 37,000.
Million.
37 million bytes, thank you. In 2004, it was 81 million bytes. This last June, it was 371 million bytes. So you can see there's a lot of activity on the website. And then another, there's even a, and this is available for you, it tells the top 10 files of which ones are the most popular. We have the Chernobyl information on there. We've got the images. We've got the press release. We've got the annual report. It tells how many... visits there were and hits for the annual report, which is, by the way, on the website.
Last year's,
and then it also lists the different domains, starting with, of course, .com and .net, and then it lists inquiries. There's 358 hits from Japan. There's also hits from Germany, Canada, Singapore, Mexico, and 22 other countries. So it's an interesting how. The internet and these websites work. So anyway, I have this information for you. And speaking of the report, of course, we now put it out on the CD, and we have several. You know, we provide this to all of the PUC, the Attorney General, the Governor, et cetera. Some of them are very happy to get CD. Some people, Truman Burns, still wants the 6-inch thick packet, I guess because he's going to go through it and read it. And but for storage purposes, of course, the CD is much nicer. So anyway, this is all available and now also available on the website. That's all I have.
Okay. We're ahead of schedule a little bit, and I'd like to propose that we take a few minutes for looking at our future schedules. That'll give us some time to revise them if we run into some problems. So item number 27 for discussion tomorrow includes future actions by the committee and further information that we'll wait and see what happens, and scheduling of future site visits, study sessions, and meetings. So I think now's the time we want to look at fact findings and outages. My calendar is buried under this pile. Next outage after this one that's starting will be how long? How far away?
April of 2006 is when it starts.
Yeah, we'll be, Vermin and I will be here on the 9th and 10th, which will be during this upcoming outage. Okay. So we'll have a chance to visit at that point.
Okay. So on the 9th and 10th, you guys will be here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Bill?
16 and 17, I believe.
16 and 17.
November?
Yes.
Okay. We've generally avoided December scheduling. As far as fact finding are concerned, Ken? Would it make any sense to try and squeeze another fact finding in December, or would we be wise to wait until after the first of the year? What's your thought on that?
We could accommodate either if it was the first part of December. Fly back this afternoon if that's all right.
Okay. Okay. How long before you might want to do another one, Bill? You want to look at February and March for you two guys?
Yeah.
Pear, any thoughts on what would be good for you, February or March?
Is that too far away? Public meeting in February.
Oh, that's right. That's right. February is public meeting. That's right in the middle of the month. So, you know, if I'm going to come late January, then maybe we ought to be looking at March and April.
I think March and April is...
For you two guys to set up fact findings. And the April one should probably be early April instead of during the outage. Unless, well, I don't know, you haven't been here during an outage, have you?
No.
We're coming during the
outage. Well, we will be in November, so that will be a count, yes.
Okay. So, will you guys communicate with Ken and talk with each other about possible dates for you?
Yeah, March, I'm pretty much open the latter part of the month. So any time around then would be fine.
And Bill, you want to check your calendar?
Sure, I'll check it.
And probably April. Well, probably early April, and if Pear is not too late in March, that'd probably be just as well.
Right.
Not too near Bill's date.
The week of the 20th would be the best for me, but other dates are fine, too.
Okay. All right. Well, as soon as you have some ideas, talk to each other and then talk with Ken.
Yeah, I'm open any time in April. Old retired guys. Lots of time.
Not your Why don't you pick a couple of days that look good to you, and you do the same?
Early, is that what you're suggesting?
Normally, we're able to accommodate those fact-finding dates. That's not normally an impact.
Okay, even during outage?
Well, even during an outage.
Yeah, you'd be limited on things you could do. But
that's correct. Sometimes availability because of the outage is a restraint. But other than that, we do our best to accommodate it.
Would it be, might be easier if you could find out when your April outage begins?
I can call also on that on the break and get you a time.
Once you do that, then I can give you some
Okay, when we get together after lunch, let's see if we can take a minute and pin that, those two dates down. And our June public meeting dates, June 7th and 8th. Any reason to change those? Where are we, can we live with them? Those are on your calendar already?
That's correct.
Okay. Do we need to look at the next public meeting at this time?
It's a good time.
It was, sure.
Yep.
So we've got a public meeting in early June, so we ought to look at another one in the late September, September, early October time frame. Anybody have anything in particular to avoid?
First week in October, if you can.
Avoid the first week in October?
Yeah.
It's far enough in the future, I don't have any conflicts.
Yeah, me either.
I will by the time we get there.
Yeah, sure.
How about the week of 16th?
16th of October,
16th. That week, that'd be the 18th, 19th.
Well, that's the way I operated all last year. So, week of October 16th.
The week of Wednesday, Thursday, 18th, 19th.
Okay. We'll take a look at Wednesday and Thursday, 18th and 19th, Ken.
Let's see what we can do in terms of the location and venue as well. So far, this one seems to be a bit off the beaten path, and we haven't attracted too many members of the public. But.
Well, Rob has got us back into the Cliffs next June, so maybe he can get us back into the Cliffs in October.
The Cliffs are Embassy Suites, probably.
Yeah,
okay. It's part of our outreach to come to the World.
It's possible that we might get some guests this afternoon.
Actually, we probably will.
Our agenda is very vague for the morning session, so it doesn't surprise me that there's a lack of interest. Okay, any other business before we break for lunch? Our schedule says that we will reconvene at 1. Am I right?
1:30.
1:30. Let's stick with that then. We'll see you at 1:30.
Was the meeting next fall September 18th, 19th, or October 18th?
October
18th. What are you going to approve the annual report?
Furman, did we need an